Welcome all NBA fans to the Mojo Sports Network NBA show. My name is Julian Balthazar, stepping in for Alexander J, our usual host, who is attending to business matters off-site. We wish him well and hope that we can do the show justice. Today we're going to deep dive into some of the craziest playoff games that we've seen, including games from this morning. We're going to talk about the sweep of the Pelicans and the Phoenix Suns. We'll talk about LeBron's future and a whole lot more. I will mention that we, unlike Klay Thompson, we actually cracked into the top 75 with our podcast. So we're probably going to dip down the ranks a little bit after that little swipe. I do love you, Klay Thompson, but for those of you who are listening and listen regularly, if you just hit that five-star button on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, I know it helps us with our podcast rankings, so please help us jump up the ratings. Let's start. Celtics are now leading 3-1, I believe. What have you seen so far?
Yeah, so in typical Celtics fashion, you know, they threw away game two, essentially. They basically just walked into it thinking that after that game one domination, they could just sleepwalk to a win, which against any team in the NBA these days, it doesn't happen, but especially this Miami Heat team. I mean, they had no defensive pressure. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but I think about 80% of the Heat threes attempted were wide open, which by any standard, let alone the playoffs, is just not acceptable in an NBA game, which, you know, led to the Heat hitting 23 threes, which was a franchise playoff record for them and would be a franchise record for most teams, I think. I mean, the Celtics, I think their franchise record is 22, which they got in game one against the Heat. Well, they tied game one against the Heat. I wasn't too overly concerned, though, because, again, you could tell the Celtics just weren't playing properly, and maybe that was the kick up the arse that they needed, because then, since then, the Celtics' intensity has just gone to a whole new level on the defensive end. I mean, the Heat have scored 84 and 88 points in games 3 and 4, and they were relatively easy wins for the Celtics. I mean, no one really has gotten completely going. I mean, Derek White had a huge game in game 4, 38 points, was just hitting everything from 3, but other than that, he hasn't exactly consistently done that. And Tatum, been a bit spotty. I wouldn't exactly say he's been at his best. There was one bit where he actually had to be pulled from the floor because he had about 3 possessions in a row in game 4 where he just turned it over or just didn't even look to pass. He basically just dribbled and, you know, they were forcing turnovers off him, which was just horrendous. And then the big news out of this series is that Porzingis injury yesterday. You know, he had that one possession where it kind of looked like he might have rolled an ankle or something. We weren't really sure. And then the next possession down the floor, had the ball, went to do a little handoff, and then straight away called for a sub. And you could tell it was a calf sort of Achilles thing. Mm. And basically, he's been diagnosed with the same thing that Giannis had. So, you know, Yuri and I are probably experts in this Ciolis strain now after the last few weeks. And, you know, like Giannis, the Celtics have given very vague reporting on this today. So that's not a great sign. You know, I mean, Giannis, at first it was maybe only a week or two, and now, what, it's been 3.5 weeks and he still hasn't played yet. I think, realistically, we'll probably won't see Paul Zingas until the conference finals. I mean, I'm not a doctor, so don't take anything from me, but just reading the tea leaves, reading how the reporting's going, I think best case is conference finals. He's a vital piece to the Celtics, and he has been the X factor all year, but assuming they get past the Heat, I feel like they should be able to manage the Cavs or the Magic, even without him. It would be great with him, but without him, they should. But with this Celtics team, who knows? And I mean, I'm not even looking ahead of tomorrow. I mean, I fully expect Boston to do what they have for the last two postseasons and somehow blow this game and probably end up having to go back to Miami for game 6. But that's how I've seen the series so far. And obviously not as exciting with injuries to the Heat stars. And I mean, even, you know, tomorrow's game, Terry Rozier is still not playing. Jamie Harkes Jr. is now out. So the Heat are just decimated. But yeah, it's still been an interesting watch.
Yeah. Great points you mentioned there. Yeah, Yuri, just speaking of decimated, they really are relying heavily on a two-man game between Hero and Adebayo from what I've noticed. Do they have any chance of putting up a decent fight tomorrow? These players are playing 40-plus minutes now. How do they string together a win?
Yeah, it's going to be super tough, I think, Julian. The success they had in game two, as Tom pointed out, with the number of just crisp ball movement which the Heat produced, right? It was almost San Antonio Spurs-like, wasn't it? Just swing the ball around the perimeter, draw the man, kick out to the perimeter. And that's where they were able to get those open threes. And I think Boston even just decided to leave Caleb Martin alone as well too. And he knocked down a couple and really hurt them. And I think he copped a fair bit as well from the Celtics fan base because of what happened in game one with that incident with Jason Tatum when he yanked him down, I think, near the free throw line. So yeah, it's just, I think that brought about some further incentive too. But the biggest part as well with what Miami, the difference between Miami and Boston's been is those scoring droughts, right? And you look at the second period of game 4, right? The Heat only scored 12 points, only had 36 points by halftime, whereas the Celtics had 61. And unfortunately, it's those periods there, 3-4 minute periods where they just completely go off and shots aren't falling. And that's where Boston will just absolutely kill you, whether, of course, it's from the 3-point line, but also from within that whole mid-range area, which, of course, Tatum and Brown excel at too. But, yeah, Porzingis' subtraction as well for however how long it is, because calf injuries are very finite in a way too, Julian and Tom. You don't want to rush someone back too early just in case they re-aggravate the same injury, then it's even longer they're on the sidelines for. So that's just going to be one to really keep an eye out for as probably the next week or two rolls by. But yeah, just how do they sort of, do they go back to that usual 2-3 zone, which they excel at too, but how much of that has really impacted Boston's ball movement? Not so much, frankly, and they tried doing that a bit in game four, and unfortunately that just completely all fell apart because Boston were able to pick them apart. And that's the thing, though, when it comes to zones, is that once you're able to penetrate in the paint and then just kick it out, it becomes wide open threes, and it's easy for the offense to just generate those clean looks. And that's where I think zone is so just, it can almost be your best friend, but at the same time, your worst enemy if you don't nail it execution-wise on the defensive end too. But just, yeah, I think for the Heat at the moment, and especially if you mentioned, Julian, just the amount of bodies they're losing at this stage is, it's just going to be a little bit tricky. But the one part they've had success in, as you mentioned too, which they had in game two with Tyler Hero and Bam Adebayo, which Tyler Hero had a career playoff high 14 assists as well. They kept nailing that one two-man action with those two, and Bam kept hitting those foul line jump shots, which caused the Celtics a lot of trouble. But they're going to have to do it a lot more frequently and consistently, and they're going to have to get Bam to at least score 35 points, even though that's not really in Bam's game because Bam is super selfless and wants to get his teammates going. But they're going to need every single amount of production with him, especially with Porzingis being out for the rest of this series.
We know Tom will be watching that tomorrow. Let's move over to a series that Tom hasn't been that big of a fan of. It's the Magic vs. Cavs, but hopefully we brought you back with a close game today. I think it was 104 to 103, the final scores. Cleveland winning this series 3-2 as it stands. Tom, have you noticed anything in particular with the last few games?
Yeah, I will admit, I haven't watched a whole lot of this series, but today, between flicking from that Knicks overtime game to the Bucks one, the Cavs Magic game was still going, and I saw the close score, and I figured I may as well chime in. So look, I watched about the last 8 minutes of the fourth, and look, from what I saw today, Banchero is ready to be that guy. He was just hitting shot after shot. He's not afraid at the moment, and he's been good. Take away those first two games of this series. He's been really good. He's been consistent across the board. Mobley with that huge block at the end to win the game, that was impressive. He's had huge question marks all season whether he can make this work. Probably not a great sign for the Cavs that this worked best when Allen wasn't playing today. I think that's what a lot of the critics have been saying, that they kind of have to pick one of the two. You have to go with Mobley just purely on age. You'd have to think an upside. And today showed you what he can do on the defensive end, and maybe he can reach the potential we thought he had a few years ago. But again, it's still just a rock fight game. And the offense is just horrendous on some stages. They had open layups towards the end and guys were just missing it. And then the big breakaways and people would just be getting fouled at the rim. It's just ugly. It's not the beautiful game of basketball. It is just, you know, it's playoff basketball to the max, basically. But just with two guys who just, two teams that aren't just offensively focused. I mean, I think neither team's gotten 100 at once, or maybe today I think they did, but it was like towards the end. I feel like the Magic will probably bounce back in game six, and then it will go back to Cleveland for game seven, which is anyone's taking. But yeah, it hasn't been pretty, and it has not been exactly on the top of my list of watching, which when we talk about these other series, it's not really hard to understand why.
If you watch game three, as you said, Paolo Banchero, some of the shots he was making were absolutely ridiculous. Have you noticed anything in particular?
I think the biggest lineup change, Julian and Tom, has been probably after game two, which Coach Jamal Mosley went back to Wendell Carter Jr. As his starting center, and that's helped significantly with their rebounding. And that was a big part today, especially late in the fourth there, where I think there was one play where Evan Mobley had to contest a shot. I think it was a Franz Wagner shot, if I'm not mistaken, and it ended up being an offensive rebound to Orlando, ended up being free throws to Wendell Carter Jr. So those are probably the deficiencies, depending on when, if Jared Allen is available for game six with that rib injury, that Orlando can take advantage of. And they've always been, this season, been a very good rebounding team, especially when you have Banchero and Wendell Carter Jr., who averages the best part of 8 rebounds a game. And you can put Jonathan Isaac in, who's also another marvelous rebounder. And that definitely causes a lot of problems for the Cavs on the backboard. So that's probably one to really watch for in game six. But I think the whole stagnation of minutes with Garland on the floor by himself and Donovan Mitchell on the floor by himself, I think that's probably helped along the way, because when you have those two together, it sort of gets a little bit isolation heavy in that part. So they've, Coach JB Bickerstaff's been able to sort of manage his starters' minutes and especially the backcourt's minutes exceptionally well through as the series has progressed too. And also he gave big minutes to Marcus Morris Sr. today. He scored 12 points in very vital minutes on when basically he was on the floor, and he hit a couple of big threes too in the fourth. And it was just what they need, the Cavs, because sort of when you minus out Donovan Mitchell, when you minus out Darius Garland, it is a pretty thin bench, and they don't have much to go to for extra scoring punch. So that's where the veterans' sort of offense that they needed really came through, and it was just super important throughout. And I think that was the one part too as well. He was heavily criticized through the first half of this series for not going to his bench more when Mitchell or Garland was struggling, and that's where it comes really critical, especially when your starters play more than 38 minutes per game.
We might stick with you, Yuri, because we've got to move over to the Bucks versus Pacers. They're back to against the wall without Lillard and Giannis. And was it game three or four that Portis got ejected within, you know, the first, what was it, 10 minutes or so, where they really needed him to step up? They lost that game. They responded well this morning. Did you watch the game, and how are you feeling about your Bucks?
Oh, I sure did, Julian, and I was pretty nervous near the end of that first quarter. We're down 31-21. I thought, oh no, here again. Indiana started 7-12 from three, and it was almost just a repeat of game four, right, when they hit a franchise record 22 threes out of 43 attempts, and it was just too many wide open looks. And then afterwards, the whole basis of our defense changed. We were able to slow the Pacers down. That was a big part, because everyone knows they love to play with this frantic pace, and they want to only use probably the best part of 6-7 seconds on the shot clock and try and get up quick shots. And we were able to stifle them into that real grinded out half court offense that we saw in game one, which served so much success. And of course, Bobby Portis Jr.'s ejection in game four, and was the first 7 minutes of the contest with Andrew Nembhard, where unfortunately he got into it with him and caught two technical fouls and was ultimately tossed out of the game. But he was big, right? The 29 points he had, to along with the 10 rebounds and just a number of his just usual traditional mid-range jumpers, right, where he was backing Siakam, he just absolutely bullied him down low. That was probably the big takeaway from it. He was able to use probably a little bit more of that weight advantage that he has over Siakam to great effect, and we just kept feeding him the ball down in the post. 24 field goal attempts for 14 makes, and it was just, you could sense early on with Bobby that he was super switched on, and especially him addressing his teammates during the shoot around, right, to apologize for his actions, which, yeah, of course people make mistakes, right, but as long as you make amends for them, which he certainly did, and Chris Middleton's game once more, he's just been absolutely stupendous this series, and his battle with Aaron Nesmith and him just backing him down on the block. And I think when you watch this series throughout, Julian, is that he's just been able to at least bully him a little bit more. And I think that's where Nesmith, who's such an excellent defender, has probably had a fair bit of trouble with Chris's little bit more of a size advantage. I think Chris has about a 3-inch height advantage over him. So he's able to sort of shoot shots over him, and that makes it so much easier for him to, yeah, take him down low. And really, they haven't doubled Chris as much as we thought they would, the Pacers. So that's just going to be another real intrigue to watch for game six. But also with Brook Lopez's performance in game four, the 27 points and 9 rebounds, and his battle with Miles Turner, who was just, yeah, absolutely shot the ball lights out, right, for career high 7 threes in the playoffs in game four of his 29 points. But it was just that committed defensive dog, right, within the Bucks that we haven't seen too much often this season, and the deflections that they were getting to. I think the biggest part, which probably summed it all up, Julian, was at the end of that third quarter there, where we doubled Tyrese on the right-hand side on the top of the arc, and he had to pass it out, right? And Pat Connaughton got his way in and intercepted the ball as the buzzer sounded. And that just pretty much summed up the whole grit and determination on the defensive side to really take an accountability and really hone in and force the Bucks into those late shocks, those late shot clock situations. And it was one of those things that you had to sit back and watch and really marvel at, because of course without Lillard and of course without Giannis, and so much being left on Chris and Bobby's shoulders, and even Brooke too, and Pat Bev as well in that second quarter where he scored those, I think it was 12 points there in the second period too, and he was giving so much punch right there, and it was just a really big time performance. And to hold the Pacers to 31% shooting from the 3-point line was even better.
What a series. Was there anything to add to that one, Tom, or should we move on to the Sixers?
I think the biggest news out of that game today was in the post-game press conference, Doc Rivers was asked about Giannis and Dame, and this is a direct quote. He said, "I think they're very, very, very close," which I have to say, that sounds basically like they're confirmed for game six, in my opinion. So I'm excited for that one. And the other one as well is, you know, Siakam has come crashing back to earth after those crazy first two games where he was setting records left, right, and center. His last three games, 17 points, 13 points, 12 points. That's not going to get it done, especially when Halliburton hasn't even scored over 20 points in all the games except for one. They need more offense. It's just not going to get done.
That's why I love stats. I did not know any of those, and that is alarming. Let's see how that one pans out. Let's go to the... Tom, I'm sure you watched this game, the Sixers versus Knicks. One of the best games I've ever seen. And I really hope that the Tyrese Maxey situation that obviously you're going to mention is talked about, because watching that, I was just in disbelief at how amazing that was. I feel like if that was Damian Lillard or Steph Curry, this clip will be shown for years and years, and I hope it is, because back's against the wall, the series down, he somehow pulls out a four-point play and a three-pointer from the logo back-to-back and somehow keeps him in the game, wins them the game. I don't think we've ever seen a better individual performance in a playoffs in such a crucial time. I honestly just hope it gets the recognition it deserves. Tom, what do you think about this game?
Well, I mean, the series as a whole is a classic at the moment. I mean, game two was just an insane ending. We had today, which was just an insane ending. And that, you know, I mean, yes, we had that blowout in Philly where Embiid went nuts and scored, 50. But today's game, again, it just was a tug of war fight throughout the whole thing. I mean, Embiid did still try his best to give away this game. I mean, he only had 7 field goals and he had 9 turnovers, which, again, it's an Embiid playoff special, an elimination game. But the big difference between this year and last year is instead of Harden being the one who had to step up, it was Maxey, and he was ready for it. And there was a lot of question marks over him winning Most Improved Award, but this is kind of what it was about. He went that level from star to all-star to, like, superstar nearly. And today's game showed that he's ready. And it's not the first time in the playoffs this year that he's shown he's ready. But that ending, I mean, when he missed those three free throws, I think it was, I kind of went, oh, no, like, don't tell me he's shrinking in the lights now when this team needs him. And then he just turned it around and went absolutely crazy at that end. I mean, the Knicks, still, you got to see how mentally strong they're going to be after this, because they blew that game at the end of regulation. I mean, they're up 6 with, 28 seconds left. They had it. I mean, the Mitchell Robinson foul on Maxey is just inexcusable. In that situation, you let the other team shoot the three, because worst case scenario, you're still up 3 with the ball and they're going to foul you.
Good point.
So I think going forward, Hardenstein's got to play more minutes over Robinson. He just hasn't looked comfortable out there, and he's just doing silly things like that. And then over time, when the Knicks went up by 5, I kind of felt like they were ready to just run over this 76ers team. And you know what? Got to give Nick Nurse credit. There are so many coaches in the league, when in overtime, they just don't call timeouts early because they're too afraid that if we lose this one, we're going to need 2 timeouts down the end. He called it straight away, and that completely killed all momentum the Knicks had, because I think the 76ers went on a 9-0 run after that. And then, yeah, I just, you got to give credit to this Philly team, and especially Embiid. He's fighting through this injury, and no, he wasn't great today, but he had some serious moments towards the end. And that one block on Brunson where he came up hobbling yet again, but continued to play in overtime was encouraging. And I don't know, my prediction for this though, I've still got the Knicks just running away with game 6. I think the 76ers are going to run out of steam in the end. And I think Embiid, it's a great story, but I feel for him at this point, because you can tell he's just really struggling on that knee.
A lot of credit has to go to the Sixers for hanging in there, but equally, Yuri, we probably have to give credit to the Knicks as well, who are still fighting without arguably their best player. And Jalen Brunson, after those first 2 games where he was shooting less than 30%, has backed it up with some huge performances. Can they finish out this series with a win, as Thomas said, and do they deserve, I guess, recognition for how far they've come with essentially playing a lot of their second unit with Josh Hart and McBride and, you know, Hardenstein stepping up to the starting lineup as well?
Well, it has been big, right, Julian? And considering the Knicks won 50 games this season, and most of those time without Julius Randle hurt his shoulder right against the Miami Heat in that January matchup. And it's a significant achievement from Tom Thibodeau. And when you think of all the teams that Tibbs has coached at Chicago and Minnesota and now with the Knicks, I think this arguably has to go down as Tibbs' greatest season, right, as coach, considering what he's had to work with too. It hasn't been easy. Probably 2012-13, I think, it's another one with Tibbs when he was at the Bulls and they didn't have Derrick Rose and had to deal with injuries with Luol Deng and Joakim Noah. And he had to really dig deep into his bench, and he sort of had to, of course, we know the same sort of repeating cycle, him playing his starters a heavy log of minutes, and he'll still have to get them through to the conference semifinals that year. But I think just with him, what he's done has just been another probably masterstroke in a way too. But in saying that, it's going to be really captivating to see now, because Bojan Bogdanović has been ruled out for the rest of the season. He's undergone foot surgery. Right. So essentially, the Knicks are going to be playing a 7-man rotation. And you think Brunson's going to be playing the best part of a full 46 to 48 minutes. Josh Hart will probably play the full 48 minutes. You'll probably have DiVincenzo playing a full, again, 45 to 48 minutes. There's a lot of strain on those starters. And that's not to say Philly's starting lineup with Embiid, Lowry, Maxey, Kelly Oubre Jr., and also with Tobias Harris, who've played their heavy log of minutes. But that's where I think it's going to play some of an effect. I just feel as though what's happened this series with, of course, New York making Embiid enemy number one for all his acts, if you want to call it that way, that he's done to the Knicks players. And I think back in Philly, right, and even Embiid said after that game four loss that I think the number of New York fans that sort of raised their probably outnumbered us in a way too with their support. And he was pretty, you can almost say livid with that too. He wasn't happy one bit, and you could definitely see a lot of that drive, and it didn't look great, right, as we saw down 696-90 and with 28 seconds left in regulation. But the amount of steely resolve that they produced from there was, I think, I can really translate back into game six and maybe, yeah, potentially carry it towards a deciding seventh game back at MSG. I just feel as though there's a little bit of petrol juice left within the 76ers.
Well, we're going to head to the break. The beautiful thing about this is, as of the last few weeks, probably about 4 weeks, the host actually doesn't have to send us to the break. Alex always gets Tom to send us there, and I'm going to do the exact same. So, Tom, without much notice or any preparation, why don't you send us to the break?
Thought maybe I'd get the night off, considering Alex isn't here. But no, sure. Look, I can't really give you any more enticing to come back for this second half than we're going to talk about the West, which is just as crazy as the East, if not crazier, considering there was two sweeps, which no one really saw coming. So, please, join us after the break.
We'll see you soon. Welcome back to this second half of the Mojo Sports Network NBA show, joined again by Tom Dev and Yuri Pilicic. Let's get into the more exciting conference, the West. I don't know if I want to call it more exciting, but there's been some interesting results. We're going to start with one of the sweeps. I don't know if you wanted to predict this. It was Thunder versus Pelicans, 4-0 sweep by the OKC Thunder. We might start with you, Yuri. How did you see this series play out? What were the keys to their success for the OKC Thunder? How much did the absence of Zion affect the Pelicans, and where to from here?
Oh, yeah, I just thought, Julian, that the series may have gone to six games. That was my prediction in favour of the Thunder. But I think probably the biggest takeaway from the series, minus, of course, Zion Williamson's absence, was the suffocating job that the Thunder's perimeter defence, and especially Lou Dort, Dion, Brandon Ingram throughout the series. And it was pretty much capped off in game four, right, where Ingram only was 2-14 from the field. And it was just a pretty frustrating night for BI. And you could see late in that third period there where he had the turnover and he was talking to one of the referees just about not getting a foul call his way. And I think that's what pretty much just, yeah, probably tipped him a little bit over the edge in terms of he wasn't getting to his spots with the consistency they'd hoped for. And yeah, maybe in game two, actually, he was able to do that in the second half with more frequency, but it just didn't occur with regularity throughout the series that he was able to get those sort of screens from Larry Nance Jr. or Jonas Valanciunas and get to his spots from the mid-range from 15, 17 feet and just pull up and knock it down. It didn't happen. And of course, CJ McCollum had a bit of an off-shooting series too. Just didn't quite get his radar going, and it just left. And I think just one thing I want to point out too, and it was in game two, actually, and I thought this was probably the biggest success or one of the biggest successes that the Pels at least were able to do was get Jonas Valanciunas going early. And he scored, was it the first 11 points in that game? And it came all within a couple of feet of the basket. And it was just basically bullying Chet Holmgren down inside. And really what the Thunder were able to just counteract with was switching, okay, well, we'll just leave Chet on the perimeter. And of course, Jonas is very slow-footed. And we'll just try and just expose him and try and stretch him away from the paint and get him to stand on the perimeter. And if Chet wasn't nailing threes, then he was just basically crossing him over, essentially, to the basket. And it almost became sort of a double-edged sword in a way, too, because for the amount of success that the Pelicans were able to generate with JV, well, the Thunder just basically did the opposite, and with Chet Holmgren, and he basically almost looked like he played already 10 postseasons, right? And this Thunder team, right, which is the youngest ever team to win a playoff series alone, too, they almost looked as though the whole combined starting five had already played the best part of 80 playoff matches altogether. It was just complete resiliency and complete just maturity for the team that I think, as we've already seen throughout the whole regular season, I think some people were surprised in a way too, the rapid ascent, but considering what they've done for the last couple of seasons, from a 24-win team in 2021-22 to a 40-win team last season and making it into the play-in and ultimately lose to the Minnesota Timberwolves for that eighth and final seed, I think it probably has come as no real shock whatsoever that they've just transcended to this next level and basically the next level of a team who's going to contend for championships in the many years to come. And I think what we saw too in game one, that was probably the Pels' best chance, having watched the full game of that. They were right with OKC neck to neck, and it ultimately came down right to that final possession there with CJ McCollum and Kayson Wallace, who was also a really big part as well in this series, him guarding BI in game four and doing an absolute marvelous job on him, just hounding him all around the place within the half-court offense. But his defense on CJ McCollum on the game's final possession in game 1-2, where he didn't leave his feet because McCollum pump-faked him. And in those situations that players normally, opposition defenders would normally bait for that and fly in and accidentally foul the shooter, but he didn't. He just basically almost let CJ fly. But in that instance, McCollum was basically leaning off balance a little bit forward and just couldn't get his momentum or going in the same direction. Ultimately, clanked that potential winning game, winning three, should I say, off the back iron. And yeah, sadly, that was really almost their chance to almost make this full statement, say, well, we're going to stick around here for 6-7 games and we may even snatch this series potentially. But that wasn't meant to be. And it was just, again, what we saw in game 4-2, those big threes, like Josh Giddey hits that transition three with about 6:05 left to knock the scores up at 80 apiece. And then Jalen Williams hits those couple of big threes. There was one there which Thunder were up 85-82 with, I think, just under 4 minutes left. And he hits that big top of the key three. And you almost felt it just that moment alone. It just broke the spirits of the Pelicans because most of the looks they were getting were pretty good in that final stanza. And just, unfortunately, they just didn't fall when they needed to go. And that's pretty much what sort of summed the whole series up to a T.
Tom, was there anything to add? I don't want to throw this to you without much preparation, but Yuri talked about Jonas Valanciunas and the domination that he had. The most minutes he played in the game was 29, and I think he only played 12 minutes in game three. Obviously, they were putting more minutes into Larry Nance Jr., but remember we talked about against, was it the Lakers, where Brandon Ingram was left off in the fourth quarter? And I don't know, has Willie Green butchered the rotations a little bit? Obviously, I'm not the head coach, and I don't know as much about him, but sometimes you just got to play your best players for as many minutes as possible, I reckon.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't watched a whole lot of Pelicans basketball over the whole season, but when I have watched them, I do quite like them when they play Larry Nance at the five, although more often than not, I like it more when Zion's there to compliment him.
Yeah.
I think Ingram getting benched, especially in that Lakers playing game, I think that's just the Pelicans' way of basically saying we're ready for him to go.
Yeah.
I know he wasn't 100%. He was coming off that knee injury, but I think they're ready to move off him. He's only got 1 year left on his contract. I fully expect him to get traded in the offseason. I reckon the Sixers might try and place a phone call because he could fit in nicely with them, opposed to maybe going after aging Paul George. But look, you already touched on it, but the maturity of this Thunder team shouldn't go, you know, it really shouldn't go unnoticed. It's kind of crazy because, you know, SGA averaged 27.3 points per game, 6 rebounds, 5 assists, and it was 47.6% from the field, which you expect from an MVP candidate. But then you go on Chet, and he averaged 15.3 points, 8.8 rebounds, 2.8 blocks, and was also 46.8% from the field. And then you go, okay, well, that's your one option and your three option, but what about your two option? Well, Jalen Williams averaged 21.3 points, 7.3 rebounds, 5 assists, 52.9% from the field. So not only did they score a lot and rebound the ball, but they also were so efficient from the field, which you just... all you need to know why this series was a sweep is you just look at those numbers and the efficiency. And that's like, that's crazy. Anyone who plays with that kind of efficiency, it's going to be hard to beat. So look, was this going to be a different series if Zion was out there, considering that the Thunder's weakness is the size? Potentially. But when you got your three scorers going at this, I don't think it was going to be any different. But that being said, they're going to be tested a hell of a lot more against the Clippers or the Mavs in the next series. And that's going to be a lot more compelling basketball to watch opposed to the Thunder versus the Pelicans was.
Yuri, did you have a little note to add there? Was it on Larry Nance or?
Yes, I did. Yeah. So I think with Larry Nance, I think something that Willie Green has been really keen on and has done throughout the whole series is those small ball lineups involving Larry Nance Jr. at center. And it's served him so much success. And right. I think also because Larry Nance Jr. is actually not a bad passer.
Yeah.
Too. And I think that's a big thing too. I think JV's an all right passer, but not probably to the levels that Larry can provide, and especially his screening is such a big element too for getting BI open. And that was something, I think that's why he probably saw those stark minutes in contrast with JV only playing those 12 minutes in game three. Whereas I think one of those, Larry Nance had played 29 minutes and he had 13 rebounds and 5 assists in one of those games. And I think that's what pretty much tells you that if you have a pretty good backup center anyway, which Larry Nance Jr. is, then you sort of don't have to solely depend too much unless you want to, as the Pelicans did, right, to go for a bit more brute physicality in the paint by having JV and running those plays for him early on, then that's always a good thing. But I think also there's also just one more takeaway before we move on to Julian. And this was right from game one with what the Thunder were trying to do offensively with SGA. They kept targeting those switches onto CJ McCollum every single time. They just wanted to pick him apart. And we saw in game one in the last 33 seconds where SGA hit that incredibly tough leaning jumper to his right, which ultimately ended up being a three-point play. It was just a completely ridiculous shot and one that only superstars like him can make. That pretty much just told you everything, that we're going to go after CJ. He's never been notoriously known as a very good defender, to the best part of an average defender. We'll pick on him. Same with Jose Alvarado. We'll just pick on him too. Same thing in game one. They targeted him a couple of times. And ultimately, if it wasn't Herb Jones or B.I. Brandon Ingram guarding him, or if not Herb Jones predominantly, then that's where, unfortunately, the Pelicans were left to be exposed a fair bit too. Maybe they could have thrown a few more double teams at SGA to try and, yeah, take the ball out of his hands and make him force up a tough sort of high up end pass. But unfortunately, they just weren't able to do that too frequently.
The next series is the only one that's tied at 2-2. It's one of the most bizarre series we're having. It's Mavericks versus Clippers. I don't know if one... Every time I watch this game, I think the Mavericks are going to win by 50 and then the Clippers are going to win the next game by 50. It is the most random series we have. I don't know what's going to happen in the next game tomorrow. Tom, you were talking a bit about the Clippers and Mavericks last week and Kyrie Irving needed to step up and support Doncic or vice versa. It was one of them. Who wins this series?
It's really a hard one to call. And, you know, the other day, I forget, might have been Monday Australian time, that the game was on early. But when I woke up, you know, quickly saw it was still going, switched it on and saw the Mavs were just ready to run rampant. And it was only when the commentator said that the Clippers were at one point were up by 31, I was just absolutely shocked. Yeah. I really don't know what to make of this series. It's just, confusing. Unfortunately for us Australians, the timings of this series have been horrendous. I think two out of the four games have been at like 5 a.m. So I really missed game one and pretty much all of game four minus the last 8 minutes or something. But look, got to give Kyrie his credit. I'm not a big Kyrie fan, but he's showing up as a second option. I mean, 31 points, 23 points, 21 points, 40 points. He had that crazy layup where he like double clutched it with three guys around him. I mean, I was up in my bed quickly on my phone and even I had to quickly check and be like, did he really just make that? Because it did not look like he was going to have any chance, but he's one of the best shot makers in the game. Let's be realistic. It's just unfortunate that, you know, he's just been crazy off the court for every season barring this one, which has been great. It's been a lot more enjoyable watching Curry play a majority of games. And look, on a Mavs perspective, Luka's doing his thing still. 29 points, 9.8 rebounds, 8.5 assists. It's just the other side of the floor. You know, basketball's, it's a two-sided game, and his defense, especially in that game four in the fourth quarter, was just awful. And look, he had 5 fouls, and you don't want Luka fouling out in a close game with 3-4 minutes left. But they just did the same play. The Clippers ran the same play time and time again, where they just got Luka in the pick and roll, got Harden onto him, and Harden literally just walked past him. I mean, I've literally seen more resistance from a turnstile than what Luka was giving. It was ridiculous. And it was the same play. Sometimes I was wondering if we were watching a replay of the previous play, because it was just a switch. Harden would go in, floater, and it was just clockwork. And it didn't really feel like the Mavs were actually trying anything different. And then the really underlining thing is, you know, Kawhi Leonard, who has signed that massive extension for the Clippers, has actually looked worse and made the team look worse when he's been out there. I mean, his most recent game, 25 minutes, 9 points. Yes, 9 rebounds, but only 2 assists. Only took 7 attempts from the field. Yeah. Didn't take a single three-pointer. -4, it just didn't look great. And he's already been ruled out for the game tomorrow, which I think is the best call. I think the Mavs look better without... the Clippers look better without him. I mean, you asked how I see this series playing out. I mean, now it's the best of three. And I just have more faith in a Luka and Kyrie team than I do in a Paul George, Harden, and a potentially one-legged Kawhi if he's going to come back at any time. So I feel like the Mavs are going to steal game five tomorrow, sort of just take the Clippers by the neck and then just run over them in game six at home.
So for those of you who didn't watch the series and saw James Harden score 33 points, I think Tom just explained how that happened. Yuri, what have you seen from this series?
I think it's been a mixture of various things too, Julian. And we saw game one, which, of course, the Clippers absolutely steamrolled the Mavericks. And don't be fooled too much by Dallas's second-half surge, because they were completely wiped off the floor in the first half. I think they only scored 30 first-half points, and it was effectively over there, which the Clippers won 109-97. But we saw game two, right? And, right, Luka Doncic, who's never been known as a savvy defender. He was lauded for his defense, right, on Kawhi Leonard, Paul George, James Harden. And I had success with Derek Lively, him and Lively's alley-oop lobs, and also with Daniel Gafford too, and it really served him extremely well. And they were just able to somehow just nail them down bit by bit by bit. And of course, that small ball, which Coach Jason Kidd loves to go to, especially crunch time in games with Maxi Kleber at the five. And of course, PJ Washington at the four. And Kleber hit that big three right, which Doncic assisted to him. And that was a big part too, because I think four of Doncic's assists out of his, I think it was about 9 or 10, came in that final term. And there was none bigger than that assist to Maxi Kleber, which at the time the score was 84-81, and Kleber hits that three to put the Mavs up 87-81 with the best part of 2 minutes remaining. And it was a really resolve in a way too, with the Mavericks defense in game two and what they were able to produce, right? And even though Kawhi returned and he was only what 7 of 17 that game two, but I think he missed all five of his 3-point attempts, so in 35 minutes of action. So he definitely took a fair bit out of his legs too, considering he hadn't played since March 31 and now he's out for game five. So, and in game three too, which of course the Mavericks absolutely turned around, it was more of that alley-oop combination with Doncic and Lively, and they just completely ran amok with that same play from the top, the high screen, you roll forward or just stand in the dunker spot, we'll just lob it up to you. Because, right, with Mason Plumlee playing sort of minimal minutes and Ivica Zubac, yes, a lot's been left onto him to try and guard both Daniel Gafford, and yes, Gafford's not an elite scorer, nor is Derek Lively, but he does sort of wear you down a fair bit. And we saw that in game three, and they just completely ran amok once more, and especially defensive physicality. And of course, that left Russell Westbrook pretty frustrated with his foul on Luka Doncic, and then PJ Washington sort of shoved him behind him, and then Westbrook went back and basically almost, you can almost say, punched him in a way too in the chest. And that led to his ejection. Of course, PJ Washington's already had a technical foul before in his ejection. So, yeah, just I think the Mavs with their whole physicality has been a real standout point, because we haven't seen too much of that sort of real gruntness about them for, well, it's they've always been known as a very high-octane offensive team, right, too, Julian? Even under Don Nelson all those years ago and Rick Carlisle, there was a lot more of that defensive emphasis, but especially Jason Kidd this season, and what they've been able to turn around has just been a big bonus. And especially, well, game four, they were just completely blown out for that first half alone, and for them to really fight back, I think that probably will give them some confidence along the way too. But also what James Harden, Paul George did, combining for 66 points without Kawhi Leonard, and basically both of them scored all their crunch time points down the stretch. No one else scored any points. And James Harden, for the amount of playoff flack in a way and sort of inconsistencies with him shooting less than 40% in most of his playoff series, he's shooting 54.1% this series, Julian, and 50% from downtown on the best part of 26 points, 4 rebounds and 7 assists. And not only the shooting percentage in game 4, which he was 12 of 17 or 4 of 5, but it was just the amount of timely shots he had down the stretch, which really counted the most.
He's recorded a block in each playoff game as well, which is vintage Harden. All right, the next game, I'm super embarrassed about this, because the last game of the regular season, I was talking up the Phoenix Suns when I saw Bradley Beal dismantle the Timberwolves, and I thought the Suns were going to take out this series, only to be swept. The big three, we had so much talk about it prior to the season, and it's turned out to be the big three disappointment, really. Tom, we'll start with you in this one. I mean, I think you were pretty big on the Timberwolves winning this series from memory, but how bad is this from the Phoenix Suns? Obviously having three of the best defensive threats out there, if you want to include Beal in that, I suppose, and just going down really without much of a fight in any of the games, really.
Well, firstly, Alex, if you're listening to this, I'm very jealous that you saved yourself a hell of a lot of time by refusing to watch the Suns for the majority of the second half of the season. I wish I could have my time back as well, because knowing that they weren't even going to win a playoff game, it feels like I wasted any time studying or watching them throughout the season. Look, I'll touch on the Timberwolves briefly, but we're going to have plenty of time, and I think we'll have at least another couple of weeks to talk about the Timberwolves going forward. But Ant Edwards proved that he's the number one guy. I had some doubts on him. He sometimes wasn't consistent. And don't get me wrong, there was a game, I think game two, he only scored 13 points, but he always feels like he hits those big shots. You know, when the crowd gets on their feet and the scoreline's getting a bit tight, and you're thinking one shot either way, and the coach is probably going to call a timeout, momentum's going to completely swing, and he always just hits them. And just seemed like they were always going over KD as well, just to rub a little bit of salt into the wounds to the Suns fans. And look, not to bring this back to my team, but it does sort of feel like Ant is kind of doing what the Celtics and the Tatum did in 2022, where in the first round, you know, sweep KD despite people thinking that it's going to be a close series. Second round, you play the defending champions. Who knows? Maybe Edwards goes and beats them. Then maybe in the conference finals, you play the one seed where, you know, people don't really take them seriously as a title threat, but still they're the one seed. But, you know, the thing that really solidified Tatum as a superstar in that playoff run was that he showed up in the big moments time after time. And Edwards is just doing that so far. Whenever the game's got clutch, and you know, I'm gonna touch on him, not to spoil it, but his game four performance is my performance of the week coming up after we finish the series. And what he was doing in the fourth quarter was just insane. And stars of the league don't even do that sort of stuff. Now, to be a bit sour and flip this one to the Suns, I mean, I just talked about performance of the week. I think performance of the century deserves to go to Bradley Beal's agent. I mean, look at his contract for the next 3 years. $50 million, $53 million, $57 million. That's just absurd. And then you add on the fact that he's got a no-trade clause. So even if the Suns had picks to attach to that contract to dump him, but they can't because he can just decide where he wants to go. The Suns don't own any of their own future first-round picks until 2031. Like, that's insane. And then they have one of the most expensive rosters in the league. They have so many restrictions on what they can and can't do with trading and free agency because of the new CBA. I think if I'm Kevin Durant, I'm wanting to get out of there. It's a bad look on him to request yet another trade, but what is this team really going to do next year? They've got Grayson Allen on that contract now too. Nurkic was nothing in the playoffs yet again. Okay. Beal was horrendous. Booker, he had, 49 in that closeout game, but they still lost, and it doesn't really feel like he's going to do a whole lot. And it's been a popular take the last 24 hours since the Suns have been eliminated, but I personally would say that the Warriors are probably the best fit for Kevin Durant, which is crazy to think him going back there, considering he left in not the best circumstances. But look, the Warriors have good young assets that the Suns could talk themselves into taking back, like Kuminga, Moody, Pazinski. And look, KD knows he fits there, and he fits the timeline because Curry's only probably got another two years at a high, high level. And Durant, look, maybe he has a little bit more in him, but his contract's only got 2 years. And I don't know. I feel like that'd be the perfect sort of reuniting of player and team because Durant doesn't really have that loyal team because the Thunder fans hate him. Warriors, yes, but also they were good before him and after him. So it's not like the fans think back at him as the great Kevin Durant, like NBA analysts do. And then Brooklyn hate him too. And if he leaves the Suns in this state, they're probably going to hate him too. So maybe you go back to the Warriors and you close it out right off to the sunset and have a good career.
That could be prediction of the year if that comes to fruition. Yuri, we'll talk about the Timberwolves a little bit, but I'd rather you focus a lot on the Suns as well because, as Tom said, man, one of the worst series we've seen from them, and Jusuf Nurkić is someone that I was paying a lot of close attention to. He looked like he was just so lazy out there with some of his defense. And I think I mentioned prior to the series starting that they're such a confidence team, and we know they've been hot and cold, but yeah, I've never seen a team drop their head so much as the Suns do when they just start to, they have a few bad moments. They just let it get worse and worse, and they just don't know how to come back from it. And I don't know. I think it's just such a disappointment, this series, from the Suns' perspective.
Well, speaking of that too, Julian, I thought the series would have gone to seven games. Yeah. I just had this sort of inkling feeling, especially after regular season, which the Suns won all three. And the big question, of course, well, big headline in a way, was Anthony Edwards been only averaging 14 points on the best part of 32% shooting from during the regular season matchups, and thought if they could curtail him, then they may go some way to winning the series. But unfortunately, that didn't pan out. And there was a really, really funny comment which Anthony Edwards made. I think some people probably pricked their ears about it too. And it was about, oh, they've got Kevin Durant, but we've got Jaden McDaniels. And people thought, you must be out of your mind. Surely Jaden McDaniels gets Kevin Durant. But guess what? Jaden McDaniels, you're going to say, was MVP of the series. After game three, which he's scored the 25 points, and no one expected him to take 17 field goal attempts.
Yeah.
Well, he did. And that was the biggest, one of the biggest arguably talking points of this series, is his defense on Booker, Bill, or Durant to take on the assignment of guarding either one of the three and just completely handed him. But when he watched, I think, the offense too, Julian and Tom, throughout the series, how many easy looks did Minnesota get within the half court? How many easy looks do I get for Ant? Oh, Gobert, you set a screen here. I'll pull up from 18, swish the ball, goes through a net. Karl Anthony Towns, yes, give me a post up and I'll just bully whoever on the block. Yep, I'll just hit a nice little 20-footer. And then you have sort of Mike Conley's just left in the open. Be like, oh, we won't guard him, just flick it over to him. Well, Mike Conley shot the best part over 40% from downtown this season. You can't leave him open. And unfortunately, it was just those broken down assignments over and over again. And we saw by game three, right, last Saturday, which most of the Suns crowd had left by the end of three because they were completely blown out of the water. And as you said, Julian, they dropped their heads. And that was always the head scratcher going into the season, was defense for this team. Yeah. They've got none of it. And is it Frank Vogel's fault? No, because Frank Vogel's always been a defensive-minded coach. And his roster teams, his team, shall I say, over the years, from the Indiana Pacers, which made two consecutive conference finals appearances in 2013-14, had a lot more tough, rugged-minded guys on the defensive end, like Paul George, Roy Hibbert, David West, Lance Stevenson, George Hill. But this Phoenix Suns team, when you take out Kevin Durant, Well, what else is left? Zilch, just about. And it was easy for Minnesota to target Bradley Beal. It was easy for them to target Devin Booker, especially for Anthony Edwards. Well, that was just almost a cherry on top. And really, that game four, and I also watched the full game too, those last 2 minutes where Bradley Beal committed those two costly turnovers, I think that was just pretty much the backbreak and him fouling out and sort of just grabbing the bottom end of the chair with the cushion and just trying to just clench it tightly with his fist. I think it just pretty much summed it all up for the Suns, sadly. And also, there was also a freaky part too, Julian, with Chris Finch. Just how scary is that?
Yeah, that's right.
I think Devin Booker shoved Mike Conley and he ran straight into Coach Finch, and Finch suffered a torn patella tendon in his knee, which was scary,
right? Yeah, couldn't coach for the rest.
Yeah, carried off.
Yeah.
So hopefully it's a speedy recovery too for Chris, because Mikal Nori, who's one of the lead assistants for the T-Wolves, who's been on Finch's staff for the best part of 3 seasons, he's also had really good credentials over the years in his time in the NBA with the Raptors and the Detroit Pistons and Sacramento Kings. So yeah, just see what happens on that end. But it was just one of those series I thought would have had a little bit more of a competitive fight from the Suns, and unfortunately, that didn't turn out that way.
I think when you go down 3-0 as well, and obviously, as we know, I don't think in history that a team has ever overcome that deficit. But I mean, it just mentally, when you go 3-0 down, I know the players in their press conferences always talk about, oh, it's just a one-game series now, we're just focusing on the next game. But really, as soon as you drop that third game when it's your home advantage, it's no good. I just don't think they could recover from that. And after that, you know, it was just all downhill for them. So super disappointing. All right, we've got a few, 10 or so minutes left. So we're going to talk about the Lakers versus Nuggets. Tom, we'll start with you. The Lakers pulled one back, as you said, last week might have happened. And then they almost looked like they were about to win another one in Denver before the Murray show erupted again in the last few minutes. I can't wait to hear your boys' thoughts on this series, because I watched every single game and I thought it was a great series. And I don't know, I feel like I was watching LeBron with a lot of admiration. I thought that he really did a lot right in this series, and obviously did a lot of complaining as well. But, you know, their backs were against the wall against a great, strong Nuggets team, and they almost had a few wins out of them, but ultimately, they just weren't good enough to compete with them in the, you know, at the end of the day. But yeah, Tom, any insights into this series, how you saw it play out, how you see the Nuggets will move forward? I know you're a very big fan of them, and I guess where to for LeBron in terms of his future and for the Lakers?
Yeah, look, the Lakers pushed them, to their credit. I can't remember the exact number, but I think it was like they led for like 80% of this series. They just could never close it out. And when the Nuggets really pushed them, they always seemed to score. And I mean, look, you can also flip it and go, well, it took two game winners from Murray in Denver for them to win those two games, where if they don't go in, maybe in overtime, the Lakers could have won those two games, and then all of a sudden, it's a whole different series. But at the end of the day, you know, Murray's one of the most clutch playoff performers we've ever seen, and he's now putting himself in that, you know, elite status, which is, it's crazy to think that he's never been an all-star or all-NBA, but who cares when you're this good in the playoffs? I'm sure he'd like those accolades, but it doesn't matter. I left the game, though, thinking that LeBron needs to leave the Lakers if he really wants to get to that 6 titles and compete with Jordan for the GOAT status. I mean, it's never a great sign when one of the top reporters in the NBA has an article on your team that basically just, you know, airs out all the dirty laundry throughout the season, just ready to go the moment they get eliminated, which is exactly what happened to the Suns and the Lakers. So I wouldn't be surprised if both of their coaches are gone, which maybe they should just trade the coaches to each other. Who knows? Vogel did win a championship with the Lakers. So, but Ham's definitely gone. If Ham's still their coach in a week, I'll be shocked. There was a report that the Lakers are considering drafting Bronny. That is 100% a please don't leave us LeBron. Like that, I'm surprised the Lakers are that desperate to keep LeBron. I think they would be better off moving off him as well. Davis had a great series. That's all you have to really say. But then at the same time, you look at Jokic's stats, 28.2 points, 16.2 rebounds, and 9.8 assists on 59.1% field goal. Yes, Davis had a great series. But at the end of the day, I think Davis needed to do more to stop Jokic than what he was doing on the offensive end. And I think that's just what's going to happen. Have to happen in the next series. And this Nuggets-Timberwolves series could be an all-timer. Because I just can't wait to see how, you know, Jokic and Gordon navigate Gobert and Kat, which would just be crazy. And then, you know, just speaking of Aaron Gordon, I couldn't leave this series thinking anything else than how underrated that trade was. The Nuggets gave up Gary Harris, RJ Hampton, and a protected 2025 first-round pick for what has turned out to be, you know, the final piece to Denver's puzzle and one of the most important pieces. You know, that game in LA when he had 29 points and just seemed like he was just getting the ball under the rim at every opportunity. It was just amazing. And I, you know, spoiler alert, but I'm picking Denver for the title still. And I do think this Timberwolves series is going to be 7, but I still pick Denver for the title at this stage.
The Lakers' inability to box out as well in crucial moments. I think you mentioned it in one of the games where I think the first game where Jamal Murray hit a game when you talked about Aaron Gordon under the ring, just getting an offensive rebound and kicking out to Porter. There was another crucial moment in the last game where Gordon got another big offensive rebound where he boxed out LeBron and he kept the game alive again. I mean, those moments are just so costly in such a crucial series. Yuri, we've got about 2 minutes if you want to touch on this game quickly for anything you notice.
Well, I think just what happened in games two and game five, right, which the Lakers had pretty sizable leads. There was that game two, of course, which are up 74-57, right, with 7 minutes left. And unfortunately, went on another scoring drought for the best part of 4 minutes where they didn't register a single field goal in that time. And the same thing in game five as well. And it's just those droughts, right, have hurt teams so much. And, of course, D'Angelo Russell had a really good game one and, well, game three or whatever it was, too. D'Lo with his shooting and Austin Reaves. And they'll have to incorporate Reaves a lot more, especially game four. So that was probably the big part. But then again, it always felt as though late in the third quarters, Julian and Tom, that the Nuggets started getting on their runs, and especially in Denver, where the altitude, of course, plays such a big part, especially the thin air and trying to breathe in as much air as possible, keep your body up and about. So I think that was the biggest scope from the series, was those late third quarters where the Lakers couldn't establish or maintain their double-digit lead, and the Nuggets were able to just whittle away bit by bit by bit, and that just ultimately was almost a near backbreaker for the Lakers. And just ultimately those two tough shots, right, with Jamal Murray, they made one over Anthony Davis to win in game two, and of course that one which he basically almost just went to his left and left Austin Reaves in his wake. And I think, yeah, it's just pretty much that's why I have to sort of take away from the series. But yeah, a lot more competitive. Well, I thought the Nuggets would win in six, but five games almost felt like six in any case.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for going through those games. Jeez, it's so impressive how you analyze the games. I thought I was good just being able to memorize the box scores, but you guys take it to another level. So with that being said, speaking of box scores and performances, we're going to close out our podcast with the performances of the week. I'm going to read out Alex's, which is Chris Middleton today. Speaking of me memorizing box scores, I can't even remember his line. He had 29 points, 12 rebounds, and 5 assists today in a big win over the Pacers. I'm going to steal the very obvious Tyrese Maxey's 46 points, 5 rebounds, 9 assists, and that clutch 3-pointer from the logo. Tom, who did you have for your performance of the week?
Yeah, I had Edwards against the Suns in game 4. I mean, 40 points, 9 rebounds, 6 assists. But you just look at his fourth quarter numbers. 16 points, 2 blocks, 6 of 7 from the field, 2 of 2 from 3, and that massive dunk. That's a winner right there.
Absolutely. And you're yourself?
Yeah, James Harden's performance, right? 33 points, 6 rebounds, 7 assists, 12 of 17 from the field and 4 of 5 from downtown in very heavy minutes. And we've seen, right, and already spoken about it in the show, that his mouth sort of playoff disappointments in a way too, but he's had a lot of great playoff performances, right, Julian and Tom? The 45 points against Golden State in the 2015 conference finals in game 4 to basically push the series to another game, which of course Houston ended up losing a couple of days later, but also the 42 points against Dallas Mavericks in the first round of that series in game 3 by memory. And last year, of course, against Boston, the 45 points in game 1 and that big 3 over Al Horford. And again in game 5 and against Utah, he had 41 points in game 1 in 2018 conference semis, the 44 points in that game 1 win over Minnesota, also in the opening round of that same playoff series, playoffs alone too. So his whole sort of credentials with playoffs are mixed in a way too, especially his field goal percentage. Of course, everyone knows that it's not the best. Most of them he shoots less than 40%, if not around 41, 42% overall. But when the Clippers needed him most, right, him and Paul George too, he just absolutely got cooking. And he exposed, as Tom said, with Luka Doncic, he just almost flew by him as though he was a standing traffic cone in a way. And the number of floaters that Harden was able to generate too, that's pretty much been his arsenal for a long time, and one that he's absolutely nailed to an absolute T. And he was just getting to every single spot that he wanted. And again, especially in that sort of pressure-packed environment, and especially in Dallas where the crowd does get pretty raucous there, it was a big result and one that hopefully does sort of set more of a precedent too, because he's already had a great series.
Fantastic. Well, that brings us to the end of our podcast show. We've recapped the games quite well there, and really, we're still starting. I know some of the series are finished, but really, we're still starting an amazing playoff series, which looks to be one to remember. So thank you so much for joining us. Alex, we hope we did you proud with your absence, and hopefully we'll see you back next week with Jack. Yuri and Tom, thank you so much for joining us. For all our listeners, again, give us a 5-star rating if you can. You can find us on mojosports.com.au or on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And we're also on Instagram and Facebook as well if you'd like to check them out. We've got a minute and 30 seconds left. So Yuri and Tom, did we have any closing statements or any pieces coming out on your websites?
Yeah, I've got one actually too, Julian. So I've been doing sort of takeaways from some of the NBA games I've been watching on my Substack profile, which you can access on LinkedIn, which is the top bar, which says subscribe to my newsletter. So you can click on all the various articles I've been doing so far in these, what, couple of weeks it's been into the playoff series. So it's always really good fun too, just sort of writing down on a piece of paper and diving into it as much as possible and trying to think of different ways to sort of engage the reader. So it's, yeah, no, it's been good fun, and you can have a look there on LinkedIn too. So been trying to do as much as possible.
Fantastic. And Tom, anything with the Raw?
No, nothing lately. And I'm about to head off overseas for a while on Sunday, so unfortunately you won't be hearing much from me. But fingers crossed, I might be doing a live cross from Boston in June, but we'll see.
Oh, looking forward to that. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you next week on Mojo Sports.
Thanks, guys.
Cheers, guys.